welcome beloved listeners to the Little Wireless program. No, it's not the Soviet Union's Internationale, it's the Greek national anthem, and I'm playing it because it's a big night in Greece and it's consequently a big night for us. As we were going to air, we heard from foreign sources that the Prime Minister has sent a letter to the European Commission, the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank, accepting the Troika's bailout proposals with conditions. So just when we thought it was the end of civilization as we know it, a shock development. Now, Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek finance minister, has promised that he will duck out of his umpteenth crisis meeting and talk to us. And there's a lot of questions I want to ask him. Does the referendum go ahead at the weekend? Are there huge reserves of drachmas hidden under the Acropolis? What the hell is going on? Who better to tell us than our old friend Yanis? Many years ago, I was lamenting the slow, inevitable, inexorable death of Australian vernacular as our colloquialisms yielded one by one to the cultural imperialism of the United States and also of the internet. But there are worse things happening than the loss of wonderful terms like drongo, and that is that much of the lovely language that's associated with landscape seems to be withering away. One of the favourite programmes I did in recent years occurred at the Edinburgh Writers' Festival when I talked to Andrew O'Hagan, the poet, and Carl Miller, the founder of the LAB, London Review of Books. Carl died last year. And they talked about wandering around Scotland together, writing poetry, and responding with language and, well, emotion to the world around them. And I think tonight's encounter with Dominic Tyler and Robert McFarlane is going to be every bit as magical as we look and think about the relationship of language to landscape and the loss of many evocative words. For example, bungle, a clod of earth used as a missile for pelting. Dag, well, in Australia it means something that adheres to the backside of a sheep, but on this occasion it means dew or heavy-lying mist on a marsh. Burnt-arsed fire, a will-o'-the-wisp. Didder, the quivering of a bog as a walker approaches. Suturing, slogger, brabble, hag, flosh. Oh, my dear. Now, I haven't started speaking in tongues. I've just been uttering once commonly used words from the British Isles, which once upon a time described the landscape, the natural world. And with the help of Dominic and Robert, many hundreds of words dating back many hundreds of years are being collected into glossaries by these self-confessed word hoarders. So let's welcome them to our little radio show. Robert McFarlane is in the comfort, I hope it's the comfort, of his Cambridge University office, where he's a fellow of Emmanuel College. His latest book about the natural world is called Landmarks. Not his first, though. Robert has written extensively about literature and landscape. And sitting in our ABC studio in London is Dominic Tyler. Now, Dominic's new book, on a similar theme, is entitled Uncommon Ground. And Dominic is also responsible for the marvellous photographs that accompany his word hoarding. And he's also responsible for the Land Reader Project. More on that later. Welcome, fellow word hoarders, Robert.
Thank you.
And Dominic.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we start on your respective books and glossaries, I need to ask how your working is going, Robert. How many miles have you chalked up at the moment?
Well, I've got some shiny bottom trousers at the moment because I'm sitting at the desk or in the teaching chair for most of the last 8 weeks. But my students have just finished their finals, and we've finished examining their finals, and now some walking can start. But yeah, thousands of miles a year, if possible, but sometimes that dwindles down a bit.
I understand that you're trying to beat the artist Richard Long, who's clocked up over 1,000 in walks from, or in a walk from Land's End at the southern tip to John of Groats in northern Scotland.
There is no beating Richard Long. His name tells it all. He has the longest legs and the most tireless stride in this country. I think he once walked 33 miles a day for 33 days, or maybe it was 38 miles for 38 days. But I would be left in the dust by Richard Long.
What about one of your heroes, poet Walker Edward Thomas? Was he a marathon runner in walking terms?
Yes, a poet who died in 1917, but was best known in his lifetime as you say as a walker writer. And well, Thomas took shortcuts. He liked hopping on his bike. So you read something like The Icknield Way from 1913, in which he walks this arguably Neolithic trackway that passes within a few miles of my home. And you realize that he's covering very long distances. And then you read a little more closely and realize that there's a bike helping him now and then. But I don't begrudge him that at all.
Please tell me that Sir Edward Elgar didn't ride a bike, because I understand he also was a walker of note.
Well, he was not a marathon walker, Elgar, but he loved covering the miles in Worcestershire and around the Malvern Hills. And there's a recorded meeting between Elgar and a proper gentleman of the road, a tramp, a homeless man, of whom there were many in the interwar years, kind of shaken out destitutes, really, as a result of the Depression and the war. And I love the thought of these two men meeting on foot, this openness of encounter that walking brings and makes possible in the landscape, and the conversation which we will never recover the contents of between these two utterly dissimilar walkers. But yes, that happened somewhere back in the early part of the last century.
Robert, you grew up in a walking family. It was forced on you as a poor innocent. But I want you to tell the listener about your walk home from Cambridge and what I think is the chalk landscape of that area of northeast England.
Well, southeast England, actually, but yes, we're thick with chalk down here, and chalk is a sort of mausoleum substance, really. It's made of the countless bodies of animalcules, effectively, that have settled down on the floors of tropical seas, the beds of tropical seas, and then been compressed. So it's a very strange substance to live on. You live on a necropolis, and you can also write with it. You know, it's a writing instrument. So we have this strange doubleness around here. We have these deep scored tracks in the landscape, which are a kind of footwork that we've written into the chalk, but the chalk also kind of coats us. You know, you end a day walking around here and you're white. You're the blackboard that the landscape is written on. So I've always been fascinated by that doubleness. But yes, just where I live, the land begins to rise. Cambridge is not famous for its mountains, but we do have these two hills that the Gog and Magog that rise to about 74 meters above sea level. And let me tell you, that is Himalayan for these parts.
And I now roll out the welcome mat for another walker. Well, that's not quite accurate. In Dominic Tyler. Dominic, you're even more eccentric because you've been swimming around the British Isles.
Yes. Not quite around the swimming Isles. One of the projects I did a while ago was working on a book called Wild Swim, which aimed to be a guidebook to the best places to swim outside in the UK.
So you haven't measured that in nautical miles, or the number of natural pools?
No, we visited, I can't remember how many spots we visited, something like 300 were in the book, and we swam in maybe half of them. So I don't measure it in nautical miles, I measure it in blue toes and numb fingers.
So swimming. So at some point swimming ends, the walking and word hoarding begins, Dom. What happened linguistically speaking?
Well, one project very much grew out of the other. It was during working on Wild Swim that I began to realise that I just had a very impoverished vocabulary for the natural world. And I grew up in rural Cornwall in the southwest, and considered myself a country person. So this came as a kind of shameful surprise and shock that I didn't have words to describe the landscape. So it was out of that shame, really, that I came to want to work on something that would collect words, rediscover them.
It's interesting. Let me just read this scrap to the listener. This is Dominic. you talk about a bland description, creating a bland experience, and you say there was a hill, then a dip, then some lumpy bits, then it got stony. I can see what you're getting at.
Yeah, you can see my frustration, because one thing about that being outside is that you want to be able to communicate about the richness of the experience, and if you don't have the language to do that, you're left floundering, as I was so often.
There's a lovely chapter in Bill Bryson's book, Made in America, when he's defending American English, and he made the point that when the English arrived in considerable numbers in what would become the United States, the scale of the landscape, the bigness and the deepness of things were beyond verbal description. There were no existing English words to cope. And he insists that a great many words that are applied to American geography had to be invented for the purpose. So, in a way, you and Bill are on, you know, are opposite sides of the same coin.
Yeah, you can only wonder at the kind of linguistic crisis that would have met the founding fathers looking out on that huge expanse and thinking, my God, what do we call all this stuff? We can't just keep saying thing all the time. It's just not going to work.
Now, tell us about some of the words you've collected. I'm just looking at a list here. Jackstraw, Zorn, Clitter, Logan, Cowbelly. Do a riff for me.
A riff? Okay, well, I can talk about some of my favourites. I think, did you mention Cowbelly, which is one of my favourites?
I did. Well, I think it's lovely, so you just do a Cowbelly.
So Cowbelly is a word I'm hoping to reintroduce to the UK. I think it may have been from here originally, but it comes from the United States. I found it in a book called Homeground, which is by Barry Lopez, edited by Barry Lopez. A great collection of words from the US. So the cowbelly is a word for the sediment, the superfine silky sediment that collects in the nooks of rivers, where the flow of the river slows so that the silt can settle, the finest silt. And the thing about cowbelly is it's a sensory experience as well as being an object, because when you walk into the corners of rivers, your feet descend into the cowbelly, and you don't really perceive a change of substance. You perceive a change of temperature as your foot descends into this incredibly silky soft sediment. It becomes slightly colder. And it's something I remember from childhood and messing around in rivers, but I'd never had a word for this thing. So discovering this word late in life was like a kind of retrospective rediscovery. I suddenly had a word for such a familiar experience. It was a wonderful find.
Jackstraw. Zorn. Tell me about Zorn, Z-A-W-N.
So Zorn is a nice word, and it's Cornish originally. It comes from the Cornish sawn, which is a word for a chasm, and a zorn is a steep-sided, narrow inlet in the cliff, and there are some great examples around Land's End at the far end of the southwest of the United Kingdom. And so what you get is a cave bashed out by the relentless waves, which then collapses. As the cliff above the cave collapses, it makes a kind of fissure. And they're amazing places for rock climbers. Rock climbers love zorns. And they've, in fact, taken the word zorn from its origins in Cornwall and translocated it all around the United Kingdom. So you find places, everywhere there are rock climbers at the coast, you'll find zorns.
This is Ali Nell, and my guests are Dominic Tyler and Robert McFarlane. And Robert, you've long been writing about words and landscape and landmarks, your latest. You've assembled, heavens above, no less than 9 glossaries of lost or disappearing words that describe things in the landscape or about the landscape of the British Isles. When did you join the ranks of word hoarding?
Well, word hoarding is actually it's a helpful phrase there, because it's Seamus Heaney uses it in his poem North, and it's an Anglo-Saxon kenning, really. He's doing that Anglo-Saxon thing of compounding two notions to create this gorgeous portmanteau, and it's actually Heaney in a way who's at the heart of this, although I've always been drawn to writers about landscape and writers who use language fascinatingly with regard to it, including your own Nobel laureate, Patrick White, for whom language actually kind of breaks under the strain of all this. But Heaney was much more bedded. And when I first started reading Heaney, you encounter words which you feel you could pick up, like pebbles. And one of those is in that same poem, North. He says, "Keep your eye clear as the bleb of an icicle." And I remember meeting that and thinking, well, that sounds like a wonderful injunction, but what is a bleb? And a bleb is actually not a very nice thing. It's a blister. But in this context, it means the little drip of water that hangs on the tip, the pendant tip of a melting icicle. And so for Heaney, that kind of gathered clarity that then depends from that superfine point is a form of lens. It's something you can look through to see the world clarified. And I love the fact that that is both a thing and this unforgettable word. And
it's absolutely exquisite, isn't it?
Good. And we have poets like Ted Hughes as well, you know, who I again grew up reading, Gerard Manley Hopkins, they all begin with H. Hopkins, Hughes and Heaney form this extraordinary triumvirate of word users and world lovers.
I think we've got another Australian that's in the ranks, and that'll be Les Murray.
Les Murray, indeed, who is, as he puts it, only interested in everything. And I love that wonderful sense of tight focus opening out to the whole world.
Now, the words you have collected are English, Welsh, Scots, Gaelic, Irish Gaelic. You're casting a very wide net, which I presume you borrowed from Dominic when he'd finished using it in his swimming.
Well, I mean, these are both books in praise of particularity, and they're also books in praise of kind of regionalism. And you talked about the founding fathers meeting America. I mean, it's important to remember that there is not only one language for a place. There are many languages. There's a range of mountain languages. There's a fractal of coastal languages. And obviously, in your country, these language issues are very live.
Well, there's also 500, or there were 500 indigenous languages.
Exactly.
Once this program did pretty much what you did. We started at one end of the famous Murray River, and we went all the way down doing little programs and interviewing people. Huh. And, of course, what I discovered was that the Murray had scores of names, all local names given by, you know, local indigenous communities. And the other thing was that no one knew who the hell Murray was. No one could tell me who this great river was named after.
Perfect. Well, I mean, what a wonderful project, and what a rejection of the as it were, the colonial superimposition. And my own book began in Gaelic. Hebridean Gaelic particularly, and Gaelic is an astonishingly responsive and connected language in terms of its lexis. So Rionach Moim, this phrase that Dominic and I both love, means the shadows cast on moorland by cumulus clouds on a sunny windy day. And you think, wow, look at that compressive poetry, that attention to a form of visual drama that is a form of beauty, but that is also a kind of reading of the weather. And all of these things get folded into that tiny little phrase. And that speaks of, a way of life, a way of seeing that I think is valuable. And so, yeah, Dominic and I were both interested in enriching and, as it were, biodiversifying.
I'm a bit concerned that this program may become linguistically orgasmic, actually. It's getting so delicious. Now, gentlemen, the words you find, the words were made by all sorts of people. They were made by fishermen and sailors and crofters and shepherds and farmers and other ordinary folk.
Yes. Who's going to answer that?
Dominic, you answer that.
Okay. Well, yes, they were. And that's one of the great things about landscape language is that people who really know the landscape, they have to invent their own language to properly refer to what they know. So they know all the particular bits. Sorry, I'm getting an echo of my own voice, which is very strange.
I can't do much about it at this stage. Just fight through it, please.
I will fight through as best I can. So there are words like doke, which is a word for the impression left by a flatfish in its sort of sleeping place in the sand. And this is it's a word that's was created by fishermen who fish for the flatfish by wading into the water in bare feet. So they obviously needed to know what the doke was and how they could find the flatfish with their feet.
This is a pastoral and linguistic LNL on RN, and my guests are word hoarders as well as walkers and in one case a swimmer, Dominic Tyler and Robert McFarlane, the latter within the Hallowed Halls of Cambridge, where they've collected a lot of words over the years. I believe they've got a dictionary full of them. And Dominic Tyler in the more prosaic confines of our ABC studio in London, although we did spread some gravel and leaves on the to make him feel more at home. Now,
yes,
I want to have a performance piece now from you guys. Dominic, would you be enough to give us some of your favourite words and their meanings?
Sure. We've done cowbelly, which is one of my favourites, but how about stunpole, which is a partially dead tree? And if you have one that's got a dead top, you can call it a stag-headed stunpole, which is nice. It's also a very good insult for someone who's a bit past their prime. Let's think, what else can we have? A meander, which is the winding loops of a river. A wellum, which is the splash left behind by a fish that's gone from the surface, which I think is a lovely thing. It could be for anything that's just left.
Look, I'm having multiple orgasms.
Okay. You're keeping them very quiet.
Right.
How about Dumbledore's a good one, which is an old word for a bumblebee.
Sorry, just run that past me again. What is
Dumbledore, was, of course, famous for being a J.K. Rowling. Well,
absolutely. I thought it was a Rowling invention, but it...
Not at all, no.
Isn't that great? Robert, what about tossing off a few?
Yeah, sure. Zwer is an Exmoor word for the noise made by a covey of partridges as they take flight. And it has that onomatopoeic quality, which is sort of ghosting a lot of what we're saying here. There's a surprising number of Zs in these wonderful regionalisms, actually. Crizzle is another. We've had Zorn. Crizzle with a double Z in the middle, which is used by John Clare. It's a Northamptonshire dialect term for the action of freezing open water. He has a line who says, "The frost gins crizzle brook and pond." But I wanted to say a quick word for comedy as well, something we've touched on already, but you may know Douglas Adams and John Lloyd.
I used to talk to Douglas Adams years and years ago. Quite regularly, yeah.
Do you know his book, The Meaning of Lif?
I do.
Yes, so you'll know, though your listeners might not, that in that book he and John Lloyd took English place names and then defined them, gave them definitions for feelings or experiences that didn't at that point have a name. I mean, it was a kind of wonderful nonsense book of visionary chaos. But I love them, and I thought I'd give a couple because here's one that Australians might recognise: Kimmeridge. The pleasurable breeze that ruffles your armpit hair as you sunbathe on the beach with your hands behind your head. And Simmons Yat, the little spoonful inside the lid of a recently opened boiled egg. And I think it's important to remember how kind of silly as well as miraculous words some of these place terms can be. And that's sort of what Lloyd and Adams were spoofing.
Oh, that's just heaven. Okay. I must ask you, Robert, about one of your heroes, to use a word that has all but vanished, heroine. Well, it hasn't vanished. It's just taken on a rather more sinister meaning. One of those who came before you in the walking and word collecting business, and I speak of the maverick novelist come naturalist, Nan Shepherd. Tell us about Nan.
Well, Nan is an extraordinary person. She's partly extraordinary because she's a woman, though she wouldn't want to be, I think, first remembered as that. She grew up in northeast Scotland in the late 19th century and made her name as a modernist novelist as part of the Scottish Renaissance in the late 20s, early 30s with a trio of novels. She lived near the Cairngorms, which is the mountain range I also grew up near, visiting very often and have been back to many times since. And she walked her... I mean, philosophy was a kind of walking and vice versa for her. It was emotion-sensitive kind of thinking, and she walked in and around and through and into, as she put it, the Cairngorms for decades, and gradually carried out kinds of philosophical thinking, but also these extraordinary kinds of writing and record of this landscape that were very much comparable with some cutting-edge philosophy that was being done in the field known as phenomenology in the Sorbonne by Maurice Merleau-Ponty. I mean, she was a regionalist who lived a pretty regional life, but walked her way into a staggering sophistication of knowledge. She was also the most gorgeously simple, lucid writer.
Well, describe her as an unpious pilgrim. She tramps around, across, and into, rather than charging up it.
Yep, Yep, she weaned herself off the summit. She lost summit fever. I've had it. Many people have had it. She had it, but she learned to go around. She says, "I want to visit the mountain as a friend might. I want to go around it in circles as a dog might." And these are wonderful forms of modesty, and they brought her to different kinds of looking. And her book, her little book, The Living Mountain, which was written in the 40s, published in 77. It has a glossary, and among its, mostly Scots, among its words, I'll just give you one, is Rory Bumlers. I always think that ought to be a kind of politician's front bench in the Tory party, but in fact it's a very noisy kind of fast-moving storm clouds. And if you've been in the Cairngorms, you've probably seen a few Rory Bumlers.
I have the advantage over all the other people involved in this program of looking at photographs of yours, Dominic, whilst I hear your two voices. And your photographs in Uncommon Ground are just bloody marvellous.
Thank you.
Particularly taken by the Fens. Tell us about the Fenlands.
Well, the Fenlands are in the east of England, and they are sort of low-lying, wet, boggy areas that have been, they've been drained for thousands of years. I think the Romans were the first to systematically try and drain the fens. But because they have great deposits, once they have been drained, they provide amazing agricultural land. So there's a long history of man and water in single combat in the fens.
Yeah, well, when you're working on a book like Uncommon Ground, do you use your photographs to trigger the prose, or do you take the photographs after, in the sense, you've thought of the prose?
That's a very good question. Of course, it happened both ways, depending on which came first. Sometimes I found an amazing word and then set out to find a picture to illustrate it. And occasionally I found an amazing image and set out to find the word that described it. So I sort of came at it from both directions.
It should be said that the photographs aren't tricky. They're not technologically show-offy. They're lucid, they're clear, and yet they've got a... Each one of them has its own shock value. You're damn good at doing it. I'm very, very impressed with that.
Now, thank you. It's very nice to hear.
Both of you, you know, you're developing these wonderful sort of glossaries, but there are, of course, already large books, large volumes concerned with flora and fauna. They, you know, they've been around for yonks. Have there been over the years, and I'll ask you this, Robert, have there been over the years local glossaries that you've found or could build on?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of this work was done. The sort of bedwork for this was done in the 19th century, which was, you know, a heyday of antiquarianism, of regional knowledge gathering in the British Isles in all sorts of ways. It was also the time when the Ordnance Survey rolled out across the country and began to change, as it were, indigenous place names and anglicise them and complicate the cartography and toponymy of these islands in ways that we're only now beginning to unravel. So the Gaelic place names get famously scrambled on Ordnance Survey maps. So it's both a time of clarification and collection and complication. So, there are these astonishing hoards. James Stout Angus's astonishing Shetlandic glossary, which is just a prose poem. I mean, he was a poet. He was the first Shetlandic poet to achieve any kind of fame writing in the Shetlandic dialect outside his island group. And he finally turned late in his life to a glossary. And it's available online. And it's an utterly beautiful document in which each definition is a tiny prose poem.
I should point out to the listener that Robert's even got a glossary on paths, words from Sussex, Kent, East Anglia, Devon, the list goes on. What do you discover about paths and words for paths, Robert?
Before I answer that, I wanted to say a word for silence, actually, and I wanted to say a word for failure, because we're relishing the ability of words to connect us to places and incite our imagination to forms of wonder and forms of care. And we should be doing that. But language is also only ever a sort of hopelessly wide net for catching experience, for catching the world, for catching qualia. And, you know, silence sometimes is famously the most eloquent response, the response of most integrity. And I'm thinking here partly about my own experiences on mountains, but anyone has a version of this. You look at something and actually you don't want to reach for language because that's a kind of mangling. You want to reach for silence and be astonished. And I'm thinking also about writers of yours, like Don Watson most recently on The Bush, or Nicholas Rothwell as well, Wings of the Kite Hawk, who are in this constant grapple between longing to layer language onto the outback, onto the bush, and an acknowledgement of its unfittedness for purpose. So, yeah, Does that make sense?
Well, it's also triggered something in my own mind. I've spent years making films, features and documentaries, and as you probably both know, at the end of shooting a scene, whether it's in a building or anywhere in the outside world, you record something called Atmos. Everyone freezes. You become a tableau. And the sound recorder takes the sound print, the fingerprint of the location. It's terribly important to be used in editing. So somewhere there are millions of hours of just silences. And, of course, silence is never silent, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't answer my question about paths. All right, you just bring hard to get on with.
No. I mean, the paths are their own. They are their own language. Causey, San, Rue, which is a gorgeous Welsh word for a rising path up a steep gradient. And they, yes, I mean they form an incantation really, which unspools across the landscape. And those words very much led me when I was walking these many miles for a book that became The Old Ways, the one before this. And so in an odd way, Landmarks has grown out of that relationship between path words and passwords, I suppose.
Dominic, one of the words you mentioned suddenly reminded me of playing marbles in the playground at my local state school, because there was a marble called a tombola, and you do a little chat about tombola, which is you connect Old Norse with Italian with ancient Greek, so you find many words that are connected all over the place, not simply within a locality, but drifting in from across the planet.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's yes, they do mix in extraordinary ways. I mean, tombolo is it's the spit between an offshore island and the mainland. So it's the bit of land that you can use to get to the island at low tide, but maybe not at high tide. But then there's also isthmus, which is, I think, from Greek. So tombolo, I think, is from Italian. I'm not sure. I haven't got it in front of me. So yeah, just for this one landscape feature, this island, you can find a whole range of languages that are involved in properly describing it, all its different aspects.
I mentioned in passing that Cambridge have a dictionary, and at this point I've now got to go hiss boo at Oxford. The Oxford Dictionary, which, you know, which is, for heaven's sake, one genuflects at the mention of it, but I've just been told that the Oxford Junior Dictionary has made a decision to excise words describing nature in the latest edition, such delights as heron, acorn, for heaven's sake, willow, bluebell. What, Robert, is going on?
Well, what's going on is not Oxford's fault, and it's important to say that they, like all vital dictionaries, are descriptive rather than prescriptive in their lexicographic principles. So they include words as they are seen to be used, as they are recorded to be used, rather than as they should be used. So Oxford is not telling us to forget about nature. Oxford is telling us that we've forgotten about nature. The Oxford Junior Dictionary is aimed at sort of 5 to 7 year olds. It is very widely used, and it is an extraordinary symptom of a retreat from both a kind of naming fluency and just an everyday relationship with basics of nature in this country. Yeah, these words went, but what's even more extraordinary are the words that took their places. Database, chat room, committee, cut and paste, MP3 player. You know, it's there it is, our shift from outside to inside. Tech is vital. Tech is incredibly, astonishingly empowering to us and to learning and to children, but it's not everything. And as we lose these nature words, we're losing another form of contact.
And yet this is happening at a time when many young people are swept up in green politics. You know, when we were just before you came on air, there was the news flash that the World Heritage Mob have decided not to announce the imminent death of our barrier reef. We think they've been pressured to piss off, basically, by the Abbott government. But this is also at a time when we are rediscovering the natural world, and that's why your timing, gentlemen, for the books is impeccable. So let me tell the listener what, yet again, who you are and what you've written. Thank you both very much for being on our little wireless program. Rob literally has to get on his bike and get to a meeting the other side of Cambridge. Off you go. Robert McFarlane, author of Landmarks, published by Hamish Hamilton. Robert teaches English at Cambridge and is a fellow of Emmanuel College there. And to you, Dominic Tyler, author of the beautifully photographed and perfectly formed book, Uncommon Ground, published by Favour. And this is a little wireless program called LNL. Tonight, I think LNL is appropriate because we're going to get very political in just a minute with Yiannis Varoufakis. I'm just dialing up his number in the studio now to try and get him out of a very, very heavy meeting. Just as the world was wobbling on its axis and about to plummet into the sun, there's a dramatic news from Athens, and I can't quite work out whether Athens has waved the white flag or lowered the Greek flag to half-mast. Who better to explain it than our friend, Greek Finance Minister Yiannis Varoufakis? What on earth is going on, Yiannis?
Well, we have an impasse. We have negotiations that have lasted for 5 months, which led on the 25th of June to an ultimatum of sorts that was delivered in the Eurogroup meeting to me. And the problem with this ultimatum was that it comprised proposals for an agreement that were not the kind of proposals that any sensible finance minister would ever accept. It's the kind of proposal you make when you want the other side to refuse it, to turn it down with probability of 100%. So the result of that was we decided that we don't have a mandate to say yes to an agreement which is clearly going to fail in the next few weeks, months, even if we agree to it. And at the same time, we didn't have a mandate in order to create a rupture with official Europe, to turn it down. So as genuine Democrats, what we decided to do was to turn to the Greek people and say, the choice is yours. So we're having a referendum this Sunday.
Are you still having the referendum?
Of course we are.
So the announcement, which is blazing away on every news service on Earth, does not mean that it's over.
Well, nothing is over, of course. Life goes on. The negotiation is continuing. We always knew that the moment we would refer this ultimatum to the Greek people, that the negotiations would heat up, so to speak.
So this was always Plan B, was it? Or Plan A?
Well, not really, because in my heart of hearts, I wanted to believe, and so did Prime Minister Tsipras and the whole government team, that in the end, official Europe and the IMF would come to us with a reasonable arrangement. We bent over backwards to accommodate them. We met them 4/5 of the way, as I think I told you last time we were speaking, and we were expecting that they would reach us, reach out towards us, in order to bring about this essential agreement. Instead of doing that, Philip, what they did was they went backwards. They, for instance, let me just give you an example that I think our audience will appreciate. They insisted that we should increase VAT, that is sales tax, in hotels to 23%, when you can see that if you look at the map of Greece, we have islands which are very close to the coast of Turkey, where hotel tax is only 7%. So essentially that would cripple the only genuine industry that we have, tourist export industry.
But Yannis, as you've been pointing out throughout this whole time, and long before you got the job, what the IMF and the EU are demanding of Greece makes it impossible for you to have anything more than a collapsed economy. You will never be able to pay your way out.
That is quite right. If I may, I'd like very succinctly in 4 or 5 points to summarize the situation for the Gladys and the Podis. I think that the reason why the negotiations have so far failed is because the Europeans are refusing to come to terms with the fact that the public debt of Greece is unpayable. The real question, as a second point, the real question facing Greece, our government, our people, is whether we want our population and the following generations to keep working in order to pay a debt that can simply not be paid. The third point, if I may, Philip, is that we're not alone in thinking that. For instance, the United States government, the IMF, come out with exactly the same verdict, that our debt is not payable. Even Europe has previously promised to restructure the Greek debt, but they have never come around to it. And finally, what we are all about is staying in the euro, having a sensible agreement on the reforms with a debt restructure which allows us to breathe within the euro and to start growing again so we can repay our debts or whatever, you know, debt remains after it has been restructured. We think that this is the only sensible way of going about it.
Okay, and but my mind is still numb with shock. But here you are, going to have the referendum on the weekend. Your government is asking for a no vote.
Of course. The reason why we're asking for a no vote is that if we believed there was a smidgen of an iota, of a whiff, of a possibility that the proposals put to us could be made to work, that Greece could get out of the woods by accepting that proposal, reforming ourselves and moving ahead, we would have accepted it. We wouldn't have taken it to the Greek people. It is because we think that there is no such chance, and actually I don't even believe that those who are proposing it believe there is a chance, that we will recover if we were to accept their proposals. This is why we're taking it to the Greek people. We're saying to them, this is a historic moment. We were elected as a government on the basis of a 40% vote. We don't have, I think, the moral authority to say that we are turning down this official proposition. On the other hand, we don't have a mandate to accept it either, given our estimation that it's simply not going to work.
Will you accept the verdict of the Greek people if they vote yes and the pundits are saying that that's extremely likely?
We made this abundantly clear. We are genuine unreconstructed Democrats. We believe that the verdict of the people has to be respected. This is why we're taking it to the people. If they say yes, we will do whatever it takes to make sure that this agreement is signed exactly as the troika of institutions, as the Eurogroup, as official Europe, the IMF, is demanding of us. But we are not going to do it until and unless the Greek people instruct us to do it.
And you, wouldn't feel duty-bound to resign and hand over to a caretaker government?
Oh, yes, we may very well do that. But we're going to do this in a spirit of cooperation with whoever takes over from us. We're not going to scuttle it. We're not going to do anything to stop the implementation of the agreement that the Greek people will have favored if the yes vote goes ahead. But look, this is a matter of democracy, Philip, because, you know, I was incensed in the Eurogroup meeting of last Saturday when we announced that we're going to hold a referendum. And I was told in no uncertain terms that this is a very strange and even inappropriate course of action we've taken. And the argument that was given to me by a colleague in the Eurogroup, whose name will remain unsaid, while everybody else was more or less nodding, was how dare you put such a complex issue to common folk? And I was just looking at them astounded, thinking, you have just negated the whole principle of democracy, which is that the common folk determine government, they determine very complex questions during elections, when you have different mandates, different electoral programs being put to the people. Suddenly, I was faced with this, how shall I put it, this negation of every democratic principle that Europe has ever stood for in front of me by colleagues who expected of me to agree with them that democracy is simply not a good idea when it comes to discussing economic and social reforming policies.
A great many prominent economists, progressives like Stiglitz and Krugman, have rallied around you on this, and they totally agree with your position. But the Greeks, as you've been pointing out to us on this program since 2010, have suffered terribly since the first austerity deals. And whatever happens, things are going to get even more dire for your people, with shortages on the shop shelves and virtually no chance of youth employment.
Philip, on the 25th of the month, we were effectively put in front of a hideous dilemma. Accept a series of proposals that will, with mathematical precision, condemn the Greek social economy to further shrinkage and to another round of brutal negotiations in 3 or 4 months, or we're going to shut down your banks. That was a dilemma we faced on the 25th of June. And we decided to put this to the Greek people in a referendum. And for that, we're being lambasted as being irresponsible, as being ideological, as being left-wing. I don't believe this is a left-wing decision. I don't think there is any government of a sovereign people that would do anything different to what we did.
Yiannis, will Greeks in Australia be able to vote in the referendum?
I don't think we have the technical facility to do this. Personally, as you can imagine, I abhor the fact that they don't have that capacity. We were planning, as part of our reforming program for the Greek bureaucracy, to introduce postal votes for expats or Greek Australians, dual citizenship Greeks. But we haven't managed to get around to that. As you can imagine, we had other things on our plate so far.
Okay. I fully understand that. And my jokes about printing drachmas in the cellars remain jokes.
Of course they do. We don't have the capacity because maybe you don't know that, but when Greece entered the euro in the year 2000, one of the things that we had to do was to get rid of all our printing presses. And that applies not just to Greece, it applies to all the Eurozone member states. That wasn't a bad thing back then because that was meant to be a process of European integration. We're all getting together to form a monetary union. This monetary union is irreversible. It is indivisible. So in order to impress upon the world that this is not a temporary phenomenon, it is not an experiment, that we mean this to be forever. We sort of bind ourselves on Ulysses' mast in an attempt to prevent ourselves from hearing the siren song of disintegration.
And the literary cross-references are wonderful.
And we smash the printing presses, so yeah. We have no printing presses.
Okay, the thing that I found is remarkable is that you can organise nonetheless the logistics to run a referendum in a couple of days. As you know, in this country, it takes months and months and months of mucking about to get even a state election up and running. How are you doing it?
Well, Philip, let me reassure you. Well, reassure you. Let me state it for the record that I believe that Australia would produce the technical solutions if you needed to have a referendum in a week if you were going to save the country. We are on a war footing in this country. When you're facing a dilemma, deliver a verdict or your banks will shut down on Monday. This concentrates the mind even of the Greek bureaucracy.
Yiannis, thank you very much for finding time for us. Yiannis Varoufakis, Greek Finance Minister. All the best for your country. What a night. And on our next, the Steinmetz affair. How an Israeli billionaire fought Rio Tinto for South Africa's richest iron ore mine. And this is the first time I've stood up at the end of the program for the Greek national anthem.